Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Anne Lamott has been called the people's author. Warm, honest, funny, real. She is unafraid to look at herself. She puts a mirror up to her own life and reflects. In her new book, Stitches, a handbook on meaning, hope, and repair, she takes on tragedies, big and small, head on. How do we grieve? How do we cope? Is there a right way, a wrong way to deal with loss? This hour on Point, Anne Lamott and the search for meaning. You can join us on air or online. How do you get through the tough times? How do you grieve? How do you learn from the struggles that you face in your life? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from San Francisco, California, is Anne Lamott. Her new book is Stitches, a handbook on meaning, hope, and repair. She's a best-selling author of numerous books. Her last one was Help, Thanks, Wow, The Three Essential Prayers. Anne Lamott, welcome back to On Point. Hello.
Hi, Jane. Thank you.
So explain the title of your book, Stitches.
Stitches. Well, I began this book the day after Newtown because I was going to be giving my Sunday school kids the chance to talk about it in 2 days. And I thought, where do you even start this conversation, since I just try to teach them that they're loved and chosen and safe, but 20 of their colleagues had been slaughtered, and how was I going to even begin? So I had the image that you just start somewhere in the torn fabric and you make a knot and you roll it between your fingers and you find one place in the cloth that will hold the knot. And then you find one place on the torn side that will receive one stitch. And once you're there, you're halfway home. So I thought we start where we are. We stick together in crisis and in real life. We get each other water. We tell the truth. We feel our feelings, and we just take it stitch by stitch. I asked someone, a priest, right away, "Is there meaning after Newtown?" And he said, "Not yet." And that was very important to tell my Sunday school kids. Meaning will come.
Read a selection from the beginning of the book. This is a part I particularly liked. You talk a little bit more about the title. Stitches.
Okay. We live stitch by stitch when we're lucky. If you fixate on the big picture, the whole shebang, the overview, you miss the stitching. And maybe the stitching is crude or it is unraveling, but if it were precise, we'd pretend that life was just fine and running like a Swiss watch. This is not helpful if, on the inside, our understanding is that life is more often like a cuckoo clock with rusty gears. In the aftermath of loss, we do what we've always done, although we are changed, maybe more afraid. We do what we can as well as we can. My pastor, Veronica, one Sunday, told the story of a sparrow lying in the street with its legs straight up in the air, sweating a little under its feathery arms. A horse walks up to the bird and asks, "What on earth are you doing?" The sparrow replies, "I heard the sky was falling and I wanted to help." The horse laughs a big, loud, sneering horse laugh and says, "Do you really think you're going to hold back the sky with those scrawny little legs?" And the sparrow says, "One does what one can."
I mentioned you're often referred to as the people's author, I think because of your warmth and your honesty. You're also a very religious person, and you talk very frankly about that in this book and in past books. What role does God and spirituality play in stitching your life together, dealing with difficulty?
Well, I think about God all the time, and I talk to God all the time, but not like maybe more conservative Christians do. I say, "Hi." I say, "It's me again." I say, "Oh, hi, help. I'm really lost, and I constantly feel the presence of goodness in my life, and I can always find a little bit of light to see by. So I don't hear God from a bullhorn or sky riding, but I do see God in the love around me and the love of other people's faces and eyes. I loved what the late, great Mr. Rogers said, that after tragedies, his mother always said, look for the helpers, because that's really where you'll see God in that kind of compassionate response. But so with God, I think I get a little bit of nudge to not give up. I get a little bit of grace, I would dare to call it, which can be a little spiritual WD-40 or a little bit of buoyancy like water wings. And I don't give up ever, and I start somewhere, and that's where the restoration of the torn cloth begins. But mostly, I think of stitches because everyone around me has always helped me so much. You know, not just with a torn hem when I'm about to go on stage, but metaphorically with a torn hem, or with a hole in my jeans, or in something that is just so drab and sad because it's so gray and uninspired. And somebody will stitch something for me that's a thing of beauty that's about warmth and creation. So it's God, but I mostly feel God in the love of my closest people, my closest friends.
It's interesting, your journey. You were born into a family of atheists, active,
yes,
fervent atheists. And I'm
yes,
curious, how was it that you found such a different path in your life?
Fundamentalist atheists. My parents were very involved with spirit in the sense of the human spirit and social justice, which is about as spiritual as things get, along with eating, which is the second most important spiritual practice. And so I grew up at the Miles Davis Holiness Temple. I grew up worshiping, literally, the New York Times. I think it was like the golden calf in our family. And so that we had directions in which to turn for meaning, but they were all artistic or in the natural world. My dad was a big hiker and bird watcher. So, but the thing that was, I think, most helpful was that I got to find my own way, that nobody was trying to get me to understand. Well, actually, they were trying to get me to understand how insane and delusional all Christians were, because my father's father had been a missionary in Japan. But other than that, I really got to find my own way. And in San Francisco in the 50s and early 60s, it was all about the Beat Generation. And my father worked at an avant-garde literary magazine called Contact with Evan Cannell. And so there was the spirituality of poetry. That was our, I would say that was our scripture. And it still is for me to some extent, but I really got to flail and lurch like Mr. Hulot into my own sense of understanding.
Part of the connection, I think, that you have with your readers, beyond your honesty, well, it is your honesty, I guess. I mean, you share your own stories. You include the very honest struggles, painful struggles that you've had. And in this book, you talk about addiction. Your parents were alcoholics. And then you, too, became...
My father was an alcoholic.
And then you, too, became an alcoholic. And I'm mm-hmm. curious if you talk a little bit about that. Why and when did you start drinking and then using drugs?
Well, I skipped a grade so that I was younger than everybody in seventh grade, you know, which I refer to as the crucible, seventh and eighth grade. In fact, that was why I was scared to have children, because I thought at some point they're going to have to go to seventh and eighth grade. But I had one anyway. And in seventh grade, I remember chugging my first beer, and it was like God had reached down and touched me, because I was a very tiny, different-looking girl. I had white, blonde, platinum, frizzy Albert Einstein hair, and I weighed like 1 pound, and I drank a beer with one of the popular girls, and I had arrived. I could breathe again. I started to think I was sort of pretty, and then boys would dance with me because it was really about how I felt about myself. And I think I just had the genetic predisposition to alcoholism and addiction, because I was off and running. I just loved it. I don't have an off switch. And when I was 14, if you and I were 14 together and drinking, you would want to get high and have a glass of wine or a beer, and then you'd feel great and want to put on the soundtrack for Hair. Whereas what I'm doing is sussing out whether you've actually finished your beer or whether I can chug the rest of it. So there's just a real difference with people that have this disease and don't have the disease. And I drank until I was 32, so almost 20 years.
When at a flea market you heard the music of a neighborhood church, and that church community helped you get sober?
Well, eventually. I was 31. I was living on a little tiny houseboat in Sausalito. And I used to go to this flea market because if you're very hungover, you wouldn't know this. You really like greasy food, and you really need to eat your body weight in greasy food in order to achieve homeostasis. So I would go to the flea market, and this one time, I mean, I'd always heard music wafting over from this really crummy, ramshackle church with this Charlie Brown Christmas tree out in front. And for some reason, it was like the Holy Spirit nudge. And I heard the music of the Civil Rights soundtrack. I heard Swing Low, Sweet Chariot, and We Shall Not Be Moved, and We Shall Overcome, and gospel music, which I do love. And so I went over there with just because I had run out of any more good ideas. I was a mess. I was really bottoming out with alcohol and drugs. And for some reason, I ended up going over there. I never stayed for the Jesus-y part, and because it made me very nervous out of my black belt codependent loyalty to my father. And then one day I stayed a little longer. And the people didn't hassle me or try to have a home visit, which I would have run screaming for my cute little life if they had. They didn't try to get me to figure anything out or to figure out who shot the Holy Ghost. They just let me sit there and start to come back to life.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking with author Anne Lamott. Her new book is called Stitches, a handbook on meaning, hope, and repair. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Quick comment from a listener on Facebook. Jane says, how does Anne so instinctively know what speaks to the heart and minds of people in a universal, real, live, spiritual way? She writes as if she is speaking to the secret hearts of millions of ordinary people and tunes in to them. That's quite a compliment, Anne. You know, I read where you said that you'd been raised to believe that to be successful, you know, you could buy it, achieve it, lease it, date it, bring it home. I think that's what you said. And I'm curious, when did you realize it had to come from the inside, that happiness was, in fact, an inside job?
Well, I think I started to realize it a little after I got sober. I got sober at 32, and I already had three published books, and I live in the same county where I was born and raised, so I'm loved out of all sense of proportion. All my relatives, cousins, uncles, etc. are there. But like almost all of us, I had that experience of feeling very Swiss cheesy on the inside of my soul, and I had always tried to fill it with, I'm very good at being very good at things, as I said in Stitches. And I'd always been in that forward thrust of getting more and more attention and trying to get this respect from the outside world, as if the publishing world has it to offer, as if you get this a certain review and it's like the FDA has given you its seal of approval and right, you're going to be well after that. It just didn't happen. I was just getting more and more empty and frazzled and at the same time. And when I got sober, it was like this train came screeching to a halt, and nothing that I had tried before was working anymore. And I tried this new way of learning stillness and of learning to get out of myself and become a person for others. I was learning that I really wasn't hungry for what I wasn't getting and achieving. I was hungry for what I wasn't giving. I was hungry for the inability to just be instead of to do and to impress. And little by little, I mean, I'm 59 and the base camp I return to is always to try to get something from the outside world to boost my spirits. And it just doesn't work any better now than it used to. And so I'll stop. I do the what I call the sacrament of plop, and I kind of pat my own shoulder and I say, it's okay, honey, and I get myself a glass of water, and then I try to breathe and get my sense of humor back. A lot of Stitches is about the miracle and grace of getting our sense of humor back when we're in clench and forward thrust and how amazing it is to be able to gently laugh at yourself again when you've been tweaked to, you know, on beyond zebra. I said in either Help, Thanks, Wow or somewhere that laughter is carbonated holiness. And when I get that sense of sweet laughing with myself back, I know I'm home.
You write, Anne Lamott, that everyone should be a seeker, even though sometimes it isn't very convenient. What is a seeker, and how does one become a seeker?
Well, it sort of has taken all of this book to describe that, but I mean it in the sense that if you're not careful, the overwhelm and speed of the modern era and the fact that we're all traveling around with our entire telecommunications devices and our purses and pockets and backpacks, if you're not careful, you live pretty unconsciously, and you race around, and you multitask. And to become a seeker is to ask yourself, if you had a year to live or 6 months to live, would you be doing the same stuff that you're going to be doing today unless there's some sort of intervention? So it's about the waking up is about no longer being willing to hit the snooze button. And I think by a certain age, everyone has lost a couple of people without whom they really can barely go on. And you start to realize the Bible says we're beautifully and fearfully made. And it means, you know, this is the body you're probably going to have this side of the grave, you know, and you might want to make peace with it. I am not going to look more like Kerry Washington this round. And so I make peace with that. And my friends have died, people I adored who were youngish, and I don't know. I'm fearfully made. I'm as vulnerable as a kitten. We all are. You know, you think that we're going to all live to be 70 or 80, and then the phone rings or the mail comes, and there's news of somebody's troubles or diagnosis or passing, and that's one chance to wake up and to seize this morning, this afternoon, this evening, and live it fully with a sense of immediacy and presence. But, boy, you got to have the intention to do that, because otherwise it's so easy to be in a kind of trance all the time.
I love what you write about forgiveness, Anne Lamott, and I wish that you would read from your book, Stitches, part of the story that you tell of the four teenage boys who accidentally started a forest fire in Mount Vision, California. It was a tragedy that had quite an extraordinary ending. Would you read that?
Yes. Mount Vision. Alone we are doomed, but by the same token we've learned that people are impossible, even the ones we love most. Especially the ones we love most. They're damaged, prickly, and set in their ways. Also, they've gotten old and a little funny, which can be draining. It is most comfortable to be invisible, to observe life from a distance, at one with our own intoxicating superior thoughts. But comfort and isolation are not where the surprises are. They are not where hope is. Hope tends to appear when we see that all sorts of disparate personalities can come together, no matter how different and jarring they may seem at first. Little kids think all colors or patterns of shirt go together with all patterns and colors of pants, and it takes us elders a minute to see that they do, in fact. Blue Madras shorts can look great with a Peter Max print top in the right hands, say of someone who has found a visual rhythm in patterns that play off each other without being chaotic. I've seen this many times. In life, the fussy beautician can be beautiful beside the motorcyclist with neck tattoos, filling boxes with donated food for Thanksgiving dinners, or reading together on the same ratty couch at the library. Only together do we somehow keep coming through unsurvivable loss, the stress of never knowing how things will shake down, to the biggest miracle of all, that against all odds, we come through the end of the world again and again, changed but intact, more or less.
So the story goes on to talk about these four boys and how the town that had been so ravaged by the fire that they set forgave these teenagers.
Yes, and put the resurrection of these teenagers ahead of the town. The whole ridge above of Mount Vision was destroyed, and the families of these boys thought that they should move out of town because it was really looked like bombs had fallen. And the town came to see and express to these families they needed the boys, they wanted the boys if healing was going to be complete. And that story just can still bring tears to my eyes.
In the book, during this section, you quote C.S. Lewis, who wrote, "If we really want to learn how to forgive, perhaps we'd better start with something easier than the Gestapo." I mean, speak to that. Practically speaking, how do you start to forgive? How do you do it?
Usually, the willingness to forgive comes from the pain I've created mentally by not forgiving. And you know, I've heard it said that not forgiving is like drinking rat poison and then waiting for the rat to die. You know, it just hurts us so badly. And I reach a certain point, like I talked about this a lot in Help Thanks Wow, where I'm done. I am so exhausted by my own best thinking and my own good ideas that I reach out for help, and I say to God and I say to my mentor and a couple of very trusted friends, I am as crazy as a loon and I cannot get over this. And that's the beginning. The beginning is to sort of hit a bottom and to get that tiny feeling that you're done and that you're available for a little bit of spiritual and mental healing. Because we start to see that people don't really do stuff to us. They're usually very rarely even thinking about us, and that there's a whole chapter in Stitches called The Overly Sensitive Child that I came this way. I came with thin skin. I came with an open heart. And everything in the culture and my family said, don't be that way. Don't have such an open heart. It's going to hurt you. Go, you know, as if you can go close your heart somehow with a switch or go to the Five and Dime and buy a thicker skin. But if you're sensitive, your feelings get hurt. And for me, at some point, I'm willing for the most amazing miracle I ever see, which is forgiveness. And I do believe that Earth is forgiveness school. I believe it's the most important lesson here, and it's the hardest thing I do. I'm not one of those Christians who's really easily able to forgive. I'm like reform, and I'm grudgy and resentful and kind of vaguely bitter. And then I drive myself crazy and I say, okay, this is one of my prayers to God. I say, okay, fine. Like, what you got? And then somebody will say something or I'll read something and I kind of sigh and I go, okay, I'll try that.
Forgiveness school. I like that. Linda is in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hi, Linda. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air with Anne Lamott.
Hi, Jane. Hi, Anne. Thank you.
Thank you.
I haven't listened to your program in a very long time, and as you say, God works in funny ways. I'm 49. I lost my mother in August. I had a hip replaced, and a diagnosis was given to me the spring before. And then after I had the hip replaced, they found that I had back issues, so I had spine surgery in May. And I'm glad to say I'm walking.
Yay.
And I was raised Catholic, Christian. I guess you would say I was conservative. But it's funny, as I went through this, I couldn't go to church, and I didn't find myself really having peace in church. However, I still wanted to pray. And you know how you're saying stitching. I am an illustrator and a writer, and although I couldn't sit at a desk, I kept sketchbooks, and I would get into that state of, you know what you're saying, like a calmness.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just interesting because I'm trying to teach my children, like, this is important to have God. I have one is an atheist, and he just doesn't believe. And as you say, at some point you have to discover it on your own. I pray that someday he'll have this gift. And I just, I don't know if you have any words of wisdom of how to, you know, maybe get a young person to, you know, realize that this is an important gift to have this love of God to get
them
through.
Yeah, that's a good question. I really hear you. And after forgiveness, my second worst area and realm is letting go. And, you know, the old saying is that everything we let go of has claw marks on it. But you really have to let go of your kids' spiritual journey. They are on their own hero's path. And I made Sam come to church until he was 14, and because we're in an integrated community of people doing a tremendous amount of service in the world to the poor and to the disenfranchised, to people who are illiterate, people who aren't eating. And I wanted Sam to know that that's the value. He didn't need to be a Christian when he grew up, but he did need to know that the only happiness was going to be probably in community and stillness and service. And you just have to let go. And there's a great acronym in Help Thanks WOW of WAIT, for W-A-I-T, why am I talking? And whenever I would try and still try to correct Sam's thinking and get it more in alignment with mine, I grip myself by my own wrists and I say, Annie, wait. And I let Sam find his way. And he has. And he has a very, very rich spirituality that is not at all like mine. The other thing is that church is not always the very best place to find union with God. And there's a lot of extremely repressed thinking and doctrinal madness of hatred and exclusion in a lot of mainstream churches. So, you know, we go to the church of Point Reyes Seashore, and we go to the church of Book Depot, and we wander, and we go to the church of the library, and we wander the stacks, because human spirit is there too, and human spirit is a little shard of the greater, you know, intelligent love energy that we might mean by the shorthand of God. Mm. So my advice, which I try not to give very often, is let go, you know, and release them, release them, release them. And it's easier said than done. And wherever you can take them, where there's going to be an outpouring of love and spirit, like a bluegrass festival, where there's going to be dancing. Now, dancing is a sacred act. And take them and let them dance with a whole lot of other people, and they will feel what we're talking about.
When you are stuck spiritually, Anne Lamott, what do you do?
Oh, first I eat just usually a tremendous amount of sugar, because my first recourse is to try to mood alter. That's what I mean by having the disease of addiction. And I try to figure things out, because I was raised by these intellectuals, and it turns out that figure it out is not a good slogan. And then what I do, I have a mentor I call Horrible Bonnie, because she's so loving, so incredibly on my side, and I call her, and I'm mewling and puking about how awful someone else's behavior is and how unable I am to manipulate them into a wiser course of action. And she'll say, oh, dearest, I'm so glad you called. And then we'll talk, and she'll usually help me get in alignment with, if not God or goodness, or good orderly direction, which is a good acronym, she'll help me realize that I am just mad as a hatter, and that I am, that what I can control is stopping all the efforts to control somebody else, or manage them, or mother them, or save them, or rescue them. Then I do the sacrament of plop. Then I pray and I meditate. Then I put my feet to my prayers and I go for a walk up in the hills. And then I go to my chief spiritual counselors, who are my two dogs, Lily and Bodhi, and it passes.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking with author Anne Lamott this hour. Her new book is called Stitches, a handbook on meaning, hope, and repair. Here is a comment from our website from Leonard, who says, Anne Lamott's writings have brought me many laughs and much comfort through the years. At the end of each of my comparative religion classes, I always read a passage of hers that deals with connecting to our spiritual selves through rest, laughter, and not taking ourselves too seriously. It always ends the course on a joyful note. Leonard, thank you. Anne Lamott, tell me the story, the very moving story that you recount in your book about your best friend, Pammy. You talk about her death, and then you talk about a shirt that she gave you and how you ended up with it in Southeast Asia. Briefly share that with us, would you?
Oh, well, I'd been best friends with Pammy forever, literally forever, and she was only 37 when she was diagnosed with metastatic, and this is 20 years ago, so the whole thing was different. But the most important thing is that when I about 2 weeks before she died, we went shopping. She was in a wheelchair with a wig, and I was trying on a tight little dress for the new boyfriend. And I said, "Does this make me look big in the hips?" And she said, "Annie, you don't have that kind of time." And that forever changed my life. And she gave me a shirt in the right around then that was a beautiful white linen shirt that hung on both of us beautifully and perfectly. And I wore it till it was really a rag, a shmata. And I kept repairing it and fixing it. And I couldn't let it go because it held her. It had held her. And in some ectoplasmic way, it still held her. And so I kept making plans to bury it in the sand in Mexico while traveling. Or finally, the story I tell in Stitches is about going to Laos with my wonderful and mad Jesuit friend, Father Tom. And finally, with fear and trembling and laughter and tears that both hydrated me and baptized me, and I was able to let go of the shirt in the river that I was sat beside with Tom, and I was able to tear it up and let it float away, and it took 15 years. And a lot of the book, I think, is about how the culture tells you that there's a certain timetable for your grief and that you should be able to get over things eventually. Now, should is always the red flag that a lie is being told. But people say that you really need to get on with it. You need to pick yourself up. So if you've lost a spouse, if you look it up on the chart, I think you have about a year to grieve and to really feel like a anvil dropped on you. Best friend, 3 months. Brother, sister, 6 months. I'm making this all up, of course, but you are supposed to get over it. And I say in the book, what if the secret is you're not supposed to get over it? And what if the other secret is you never will? If you're lucky, the person will stay alive in your heart because your heart stays a little bit open through crying, through continuing to talk with wistfulness and even blinking back tears at how loved you felt when this person was still alive and how much you miss them. So I just think it's a great palace lie that we're supposed to get over certain losses because actually they're a great blessing. One thing that isn't in this book, but my friend David Roach, who has a very severe facial deformity, says that as he grew, as he evolved spiritually and psychologically, he came to see that his face was an elaborately disguised gift from God because it forced him to go deeper and deeper and deeper into himself because the face wasn't all that great, you know. So he went into his heart, he went into his soul, he went into his spirit, he went into where we are all one. And that's how I feel about grief. And you know, I still miss Pammy, but of course it becomes much, much less acute.
Here's Daniel in Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Daniel. I'm glad you called. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I think, first of all, Anne's honesty, just being honest to God and honest with each other, is what makes all of us scream, yes, yes, I felt that same way when she writes and when she speaks. In this last hour, you've touched on the greatest issues of my life over the 12 years. My wife, a psychiatrist, addicted to Adderall and hydrocodone and Ambien, mm-hmm. and the death of our 21-year-old son 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And there aren't human words. But, mm-hmm. and she just touched on it. C.S. Lewis says in The Grief Observed, it's in the loss of a loved one or child that, yes, it's like having your leg amputated. Not like in a man who's had an appendicitis and had his appendix removed, mm-hmm. and people say, you know, are you healed? But mm-hmm. that there will be phantom pain, and that every morning when you put on your pants, you'll realize, I'll never be a biped again. Mm-hmm. And But we do have, it's very un-American to grieve, especially for a man, especially for a man. And it actually has become un-Christian. I was shocked that really we were sort of shunned by the church after a month.
Oh, you know? Because you're supposed to have wrapped it up. It's very inconvenient and painful for other people to see you so wet with tears, but the tears are going to hydrate you. The tears are going to wash you, and they're going to hydrate the ground at your feet and at your wife's feet, and who knows what's going to grow from that. Something will grow from that that is of your son, that is him in life again in a way that is still excruciating. And I think it's such a lie to minimize that and to try to wrap it up with a nice bow as if you can go put it out in the garage when you're done. And I think it's a radical act to insist on grieving and on being heartbroken for as long as you naturally need to be. And I really, really support you and your wife in being true to yourself and being true to your child, in staying in what is real and not going along with this, you know, happy, you know what, that it's getting better and that, wow, it's funny, you're really getting somewhere now. No, this is outside of time and space.
Daniel.
So anyway, God bless you both.
Daniel, thank you very much for the call. You take care. Here's Laura in Boston. Laura, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Of course.
And I just wanted to say to you, thank you. About 14 years ago, and it was exactly 14 years ago, I had what I now know was a really severe panic attack and started off a whole cycle of panic disorder. And that night, when I didn't know what was happening to me and I was really scared out of my wits, my husband, who's an English teacher, happened to have a copy of Traveling Mercies, and he just started reading to me. And your words just calmed me so much. And I carried that book around for the next year like a Bible. And there was something wonderful about there was almost a cadence of the constant reminder of just taking it one day at a time and remembering to breathe and forgive. And they just sort of lulled me back to sanity. And I've always wanted to have the opportunity to say thank you. So thank you.
Oh, thank you.
What a nice story. Laura, thank you very much.
Yeah, the message is that we're all in the same boat and that the culture tells us to work on the package and the appearance and the people that we love most, and I hope I am able to say we're all in the same boat. We're all torn. We're all ravaged sometimes, and we're all here to help one another, and you're not alone. And breathe and get yourself a nice glass of water, and I think it's always good to rub a little lotion into your hands.
Beth is calling from Charleston, South Carolina. Hello, Beth. You're on the air.
Hi. How are y'all?
Hi. Fine. Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you. And I'm over 20 years sober myself, and this is a very emotional hour for me, and I'm so grateful to you for bringing everything to us. I don't know how to forgive myself, and I don't know how to get over the loss of the Beth that I was before I started drinking. I miss her, and it's easier to forgive others than it is myself, and to love myself seems just so hard.
Well, no one mentions this when you're growing up or when you're in your teens and 20s, that the work here is the self-acceptance, and the Gerald May, the great doctor and a writer, said self-acceptance is freedom, but we don't have a switch. We can't just self-will ourselves into self-acceptance. But I think we learn little by little by little by immersing ourselves in healing writers, and especially for me, poetry and beautiful movies and fellowship, that all these people seem to think we're beautiful and funny and touching and kind of heroic, and yet we alone think we're just such a mess. Well, maybe the truth is that we're both, and maybe we're all beautiful and torn and a mess and of the divine, and here we are. And the think of what my friend Pammy said, you don't have that kind of time. So you get to start your new 24 hours over whenever you remember that you're harshing yourself, and that if you take the action, the insight will follow. Figure it out is not a good slogan, but if you take the action, rubbing lotion into your hands, getting yourself a drink of water, taking yourself on a short and beautiful walk, buying yourself a $8 pair of great socks like you would buy for your very best girlfriend, then the insight follows and the insight is, wow, that was really nice to feel that sense of union and sweetness towards myself. And I think it's the hardest work we do.
Beth, thank you very much for the call. Anne, would you talk about the power of a prayer of gratitude?
Oh, yeah. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. It's the second great prayer. In my experience, 100% of the time, if we cry out from our deepest, truest self, from our heart, from the heart cave, for help, our prayers will be answered. And I say, when I pray to God, I say, I am thanking you in advance for hearing my prayer and for your tender mercies, because 100% of the time my prayers have been answered. I mean, unfortunately, sometimes the answer is no, or not at this time, please call back during regular office hours. But my experience also is that if I get what I pray for, I'm shortchanging myself, and that God and life have something better in mind, and I just have to kind of keep the patient comfortable until that is revealed. But when I say thank you, to me, I forgot who it was. I'm sorry. I'm having a little moment. But somebody famously said, if thank you is the only prayer you ever say, you're good. You're good to go.
That's enough.
Because, yeah, to say thank you is the praise prayer. To just say thank you. You know, you kind of sigh or you exhale when you say it. It is such a miracle for things to get even just a tiny bit better when they've been so grim or so stuck, and to get a little tiny bit, to be able to breathe again and to sigh, and for your shoulder, to let down your shoulders. It's a really beautiful little brown bag miracle. And I always say, thank you.
One more quick call from Kelly in Blair, Nebraska. Hi, Kelly. I'm glad you waited. We're running out of time, but I wanted to get you in here. Go ahead.
Hi, Jane. Thank you so much. I'm going to shift the discussion back to Bird by Bird, one of my favorite books of Anne Lamott, and I'm so thrilled to be talking right now. And briefly, I pre-order and I give gifts of all of your books because I love them so much. Shifting back to that the process of writing, though, I'm sitting my butt in the chair, I'm trying to do the work, and I'm still procrastinating and then not having self-compassion that I procrastinate. And do you have any advice on just that, plugging through that and not being judgmental when you're creative, when you're so creative of creating distractions?
Well, every single thing I know, I crammed into Bird by Bird. And, you know, Stitches is my 15th book, and I still will sit down with the exact same experiences you've just described. I never am in the mood for writing. I'd much rather watch MSNBC or play with the cat, you know. And I have developed the habit, because if I get that day's work done, I'm going to feel different all afternoon, because it's such a blessing to have been given the hunger and thirst to be a writer, to become a writer, to become a person of reading, to become part of the literary world, to be a person who believes in story. You know, Barry Lopez famously said that when all is said and done, all we really have is compassion and story. So if you are one of the storytellers for the culture, it's really a sacred calling. And we do it by prearrangement. I don't say to myself that I'm going to wait for inspiration, because that's just another way of not getting my work done. I sit down at the same time every day, and I am passionately pro-gun control, but I hold an imaginary sort of maybe potato gun to my head, and I say to my tiny princess self, I say, Annie, sit, butt in chair. We're going to write a terrible first draft of that one passage where you and your uncle are in Inverness out in West Marin for the first time, and your first memory of stepping into that cold, water. Mm-hmm. And that's all I'm going to do, you know, sufficient unto the day. It's all I'm going to do. I'm going to write a bad draft. I'm going to write a short assignment, and then I'm going to raise my arms in victory. That's keep butt in chair, secret of life.
Anne Lamott, leave us with one thought in our last minute and a half here. What you've learned in your life's journey, as you talk about in your book, about the mystery of God and grace.
I've learned, as my pastor has taught me, as the elders have taught me at my church, that grace meets us exactly where we are, and then it doesn't leave us where it found us. That it lifts us, it gives us a little bit of buoyancy or a little bit of stamina, a little, you know, a second wind, a little bit of fresh air, and it will be sufficient for us to continue going left foot, right foot, left foot, breathe, and there will be help. There will be wholeness. There will be healing. It will be better, and I can promise everyone that, as I promise myself that every day.
Anne Lamott's new book is called Stitches, a handbook on meaning, hope, and repair. Anne Lamott, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, Jane, thank you so much. I loved it.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow for Halloween, we look at the horror genre today in the movies and in print with some of the best Frightmeisters in the business. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.